Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup for December 23rd, 2020. And just a quick note to our listeners and watchers online, this will be our final Midweek Roundup for 2020. We'll be taking a week off next week in between Christmas and New Year's and coming back to you again in early January with our thoughts on what the new year has to offer in terms of international education news. So thanks for being with us this past year. It's been a real pleasure coming into your offices, into your work from home spaces during this pandemic filled year and talking about the issues that are upfront and personal for many of us in our day-to-day lives in international education. For those that are new to the Roundup, each week on Wednesday, we take a look at three questions that we've been hearing from international educators in the past few days, mostly coming from news stories we've seen in the major news outlets and others that we find from around the world that focus both on social media stories as well as international education stories, and oftentimes where those two overlap. So what we'll do today is we'll take a look at three questions that have been popping in our news stories, and oftentimes we'll see themes occurring in a series of news stories and present our take on those and others as they tend to provide some color into what we do in our business in terms of filling in the blanks, filling in those spaces for our daily jobs, giving us the perspective we need, I think, on a lot of different issues related to international education. Those that are watching live here on Facebook, it's always a pleasure to get your input during the course of the discussion, this half hour midweek roundup. Those that watch on repeat on YouTube or our Facebook page, thank you so much for making us a part of your journey. And especially a shout out to those that make it a point to download our podcast version of the midweek roundup to listen while you work or work out or whatever meditation rituals you go through. If this helps, I'm certainly glad to provide that kind of color for your week in talking about our international education field and what changes are coming down the pike for all of us. So let's get right to it. This week, probably one of the more not insightful articles, and it's actually a white paper from QS that came out that was more a promo for their version of how you can create online content for international students. And it was a white paper that was produced. I'll be dropping the links to all the major stories here and articles and white papers into the comments section on the Facebook page. So if you need more information about any of these topics, you can get that from the links that I'm providing there. Or if you haven't already subscribed to our newsletter, which comes out Mondays, all the SMIE news fit to share, you can subscribe to that and get that email on Monday morning that has all the links to these news stories in your inbox on Monday. So the white paper is actually entitled How to Create Online Content That Drives Students to Your Institution. And this is a fairly standard topic that many service providers out there make an effort to help be a resource, much like we do here on SMIE Consulting, try and be a service to potential clients on the university side, provide that kind of content that helps you as international educators better understand the mindset of students that you're attempting to recruit to your institutions. And I think there's some good useful tools in here that are well worth considering. But what I found, just for general purposes, but what I found really important about the perspective that this QS report does give to international educators, particularly those of you on the international mission side, that taking a perspective, and this isn't something I'm talking about a lot in a series I'm starting in January for IDP Connect on using what I'm calling the six P's of international or strategic international enrollment management. The first P is perspective, and having your student perspective understood in terms of where they're coming from, in terms of their process for determining what they're going to study, where they're going to study, all of that kind of fun details that help us have a better way and position ourselves as institutions better to reach those students. I think this is an important piece of that puzzle. The article, the white paper really goes through the timing piece of content strategy in terms of messaging, when that goes out and the kinds of messaging that goes out and where it helps inform institutions on where students are going to get the content that they need to inform their institutional searches, how to refresh your own institution, your online presence. Talk about enhancing SEO with topic clusters and all that. Some good stuff in there. But what I want to pay particular attention to in this white paper is something they talk about is the student journey. And that is really informed for institutions in the U.S. for a long, long time when designing a recruitment plan. Oftentimes, it's just a year at a time. We'll see how it goes and make adjustments after a year and then not really have a comprehensiveness or a long-term vision for those plans that really doesn't help lead to a comprehensive and integrated plan. So what this QS report helps me put in perspective, I think, is an understanding that we all know is true in international education circles that, particularly if you're at the SIO level, you know that students around the world that are looking outside their home country for study options, those numbers have grown dramatically over the last 20 years. Back in 2000, there were about 2.1 million globally mobile students. By 2019, that number was over 5 million. So it's been more than doubled in that time, 2.7 million to 5 million, I think, 5.1 million. So the numbers have doubled more than doubled in that in a 20-year period. And what that means is as we know in the U.S., we have maintained our reputation and de facto status as the most popular destination for international students. We went from 550,000 to well over a million international students in 20 years. And that has, what has also happened in that same period is that our share of the international student mobility pie has shrunk from about 29% to probably closer to 20-21% this year. And that means, frankly, there are more players out there. International students have more options. In terms of where they can go. Other countries have been ramping up their international student marketing efforts and recruitment efforts and being more comprehensive and cooperative in their approach towards international education. They've had, in many cases, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, UK, have had governmental support to make that happen. But they've also had to work, individual institutions have had to work very hard on their own to make things happen. Now, what the QS report does put into perspective for us is the kind of the funnel that we're talking about with prospective students before they even get to your individual institution. And this is that pre-admissions funnel process that I think we all know about stealth applicants, stealth prospects that kind of enter into our admissions funnel, even as late as the application stage, when that might be the first time you hear about a particular student's interest in your institution. What I think is important, and particularly if you're doing list buys, TOEFL, IELTS names that you're buying, other test scores when they're available, if they're available, to get at prospective students before they become your inquiries, that you're actually marketing to them directly. How do you do that? Where do you go? And that's not necessarily what we're going to focus on here, but it's talking about what that process looks like. And for many students outside of the United States, we talk about in the U.S. how our institutions are set up and are flexible and you don't have to decide your major right away. And most students will change their major before they graduate. And in the first 2 years, you can still graduate on time if you change your major in many cases. That's the reality of what most international students are facing when they're looking at the university admissions process or where they're going to study. choosing their subject, what course they wish to study, happens well before they figure out which institution they're going to apply to. And that's really where it's a different mindset, frankly, for institutions in the U.S. that are so used to talking about the flexibility of our programs, unless you're a specialty school like music or engineering or art, where if that's your only focus, then it makes it fairly clear that, hey, you're recruiting for music, you're recruiting for engineering. It's identifying who those prospects are. And if you have that early on enough in the process, while they're still prospects and you know that they've identified what they want to study, then you can really go after them. But for most institutions that are promoting multiple majors and using a theme and content in that first contact with a student that focuses on things other than the major academic subject, it oftentimes you are missing the opportunity to bring that student further into your environment, to make them an initial inquiry, to get their attention and to encourage them to explore further. Because those students have already made decisions on major, and if you have that captured, you need to laser focus in on that, because that needs to be the first piece that an international student's going to use as a way to eliminate you. And if you're not focusing on the academic side of things from the outset in your initial outreach to student prospects before they become your inquiries, or even at that inquiry stage, obviously they found you because you have that academic program they're looking for in most cases. You also need to factor in the other piece. If they're going to study overseas, they're going to study the subject that they want to study. And that's number one. But they are also, because of what we're talking about earlier with the variety of choices that international students have, they're also choosing countries that they might want to apply to. And it may not just be one, it may be two or three different countries and institutions within those countries that they might apply to. If they get really hooked on a particular destination, whether it's because of a video they've seen from an education New Zealand or Australia universities coalition, or whatever it might be, universities UK, international, those things, or even an Education USA video or promo that they've seen, they might be attracted to one country more than another, where they might have two institutions in a country that they might apply to. But the point is that students are selecting destination countries after they picked their academic subject that they wish to study. So the mindset of we don't know the numbers on how many international students that are applying outside their home countries are applying to multiple countries, but we know that that phenomenon exists. We've seen that happen over, particularly during the pandemic, when students had to defer or decide to not come to the United States or other destination countries for reasons no simpler than they couldn't get in to those countries physically. They didn't want to study abroad, study remotely. So it's aside from that, the fact that students select an academic subject first they wish to study, they then look at destination countries they wish to study. And only after they've identified countries that might be good destinations do they then select universities. We tend to take things from a U.S. admissions perspective, particularly for institutions where international is within domestic admissions office. That's often not a huge priority or a high priority, particularly at the undergrad side. So oftentimes it's, well, this is the way we market our institution, so the same rules must apply overseas. We might need to tweak some language here and there, but the reality is it's a different situation. And when I work with my university clients, I often focus on that piece because it's the perspective on what a domestic student in rural Kansas might want and expect in their college admissions journey is going to be dramatically different than what a student in Shanghai or a student in Pune, India might expect, or in rural New Zealand might expect for their college admissions journey. So having messaging that just is cut and paste from a domestic mindset to an international mindset clearly doesn't work. And having information in your initial contacts with prospects, even before they become inquiries, but even after they become inquiries, that acknowledges their journey, that they have other options globally, that they do have interests in looking at multiple countries, even that you acknowledge that fact, that they have, you're glad that they have an idea of what they want to study, but acknowledge that they may have other countries that they're looking at as possible destinations, not just assuming that the U.S. and your institution is all that they're going to be applying to. Don't expect they know everything about you and about the United States and about your institution yet, but do be able to explain some of that as part of your initial outreach to them. Is, hey, we know you have options. We know that there are fantastic institutions around the world that you could choose from for the subject you want to study. But here's a reason why that our institution will be great for you, but that the United States as a destination will be good for you. And that's something that I think oftentimes we lose sight of. I know for the last 4 years, a lot of us have been saying or apologizing for our country's, certainly our government's attitudes towards things international and different. And that now we're in a position where, yeah, there's going to be change of administration. Yes, it's going to be more international friendly, but be able to articulate the benefits of studying in the United States, not just at your institution. Because it's all you're going to sell your institution, yes, but you're also selling your academic program and you're selling your country as a destination of why international students should be considering you, your country, your institution, and your academic program. So those are the things that you need to be focusing on at the front end of your messaging out to international students. And I'm really, really appreciate QS's white paper here on this subject. It's just the early part of their story of the white paper that really touches on this student journey. And I think it's well worth having a read, at least for that initial piece, but certainly there are going to be other elements there that you'll want to check out as well. Now let's move on to our second question here is, do university president's words matter to the U.S. president and president-elect? What we've seen, we certainly saw it when there were major issues that popped up on that affected campuses, whether it was immigration regulations, travel bans, and potential DHS rulings on online study restrictions, hybrid study restrictions for continuing students. That's what usually drives a lot of letters from university presidents. I think there is value here because when university presidents are taking initiative to write these letters urging action one way or the other, that shows their engagement. And certainly many of us who have worked on the institutional side who have not had institutional presidents that have been proactive or willing or able to write these kind of letters because of domestic political concerns or community concerns related to taking stances like that. I've certainly been on campuses like that. But when you have an institution leader, in this case, we're talking about the leadership at Harvard University for Larry Bacow and at Columbia University, President Bollinger, have Lee Bollinger there. Both have written letters in the last week to President-elect Biden asking for his administration to take a much more international friendly approach to their messaging, at least, and reversing a lot of the initiatives that Trump administration had put in place in the last 4 years, talking about reversal of travel bans, backing DACA, temporary protected status for students and individuals coming from certain countries where there are significant disasters or wars, that type of thing. And the phrase that I like coming out of Larry Bacow's article is, until we are able to achieve a more permanent solution, protections will be necessary to ensure that these individuals do not lose the right to live and work in the United States, including many at Harvard. He's talking about a lot of different variables on the travel bans and temporary protected status and the DACA students that have enrolled at Harvard. So with energy, talent, and determination, immigrants have helped make our nation economy and communities stronger and more prosperous. That's another quote from the letter. So it's interesting to see this, and certainly one that I I feel is very helpful to for U.S. colleges to see leaders like this having the backing of taking the initiative to write these letters in the first place, and certainly spelling out priorities from a higher ed perspective, not just their own institution. So I think it's important that it's put in perspective that these, oftentimes when these letters are written, they're not just talking about their own institutional concerns, but are more trying to be more largely representative of higher education in the United States as ways that these are their positions are reflective of larger higher ed concerns. So I think these kind of letters do have value. I think there's obviously going to be some self-serving pieces in here, but when you look at, and they talk about their Nobel Prize winners that they have at Harvard and all of that, and that's I get that. They want to put that in there and make sure he's aware. I think Biden obviously is one of the first non-Ivy League presidents if not the first to not never have studied at an Ivy League institution. I think that's significant. Whether or not somebody like President of Harvard and Columbia, both Ivy League schools, will impact him the same way as it did other presidents who have been out of the Ivy League system. So that's going to be interesting to see how that dynamic works. But that I think both of the presidents do take this perspective here that it's in the United States' best interest to remain a world leader in higher education, that we cannot become isolated from a discourse that happens outside our borders, all of that. So I think that there's a lot, and certainly the international folks at these institutions, Maureen Martin, the Director of Immigration Services for Harvard's international offices, said she welcomed Baco's continued support on such an important topic. And obviously she forwarded on to her staff and shares with them how much they are supported by their institution. And that is gold as far as international offices are concerned, when you have that, a leader that does take the initiative. And I certainly more, I think, for internal than external benefit in terms of kind of a rallying the troops kind of a cry. So kudos to both presidents, especially for Lee Bollinger's piece. He takes a much more critical tone and says that quote-unquote costly and consequential federal policies have damaged American universities' ability to attract top talent from around the globe. And that's something that I think that will resonate with President-elect Biden, certainly as a message that up until Trump, international education was really a white hat issue in terms of political speak. And that means it was a bipartisan issue, that it was clearly seen as beneficial to both to all sides on the political spectrum in terms of the value of bringing students in from overseas, sending our students overseas to study. All of that has traditionally been a white hat issue. It certainly went a very different direction in the last 4 years. And now we're hoping for a return to a more traditional interpretation of international education, perhaps a heightened value be placed on international ed. And I think that's part of what both presidents are gearing their messaging towards the president-elect. So it's talking about the restrictions that have been put in place and the damage done and the reputational piece and just the physical ability for international students to enter the United States and begin their studies, all of that. So I think there's, Bollinger has a list of about seven things that are fairly standard that we've talked about here on the roundup before. Student aid for Dreamers and creating, now that DACA has been allowed to continue, a travel bans, repealing those, non-immigrant visa applications has a request to fund state and USCIS to the levels needed to reduce backlog of requested visa renewals and applications for new non-immigrant visas. Duration of status, getting rid of that proposal that Trump laid out. H-1B and visa, and H-1B and OPT protection, restoring that and strengthening and expanding H-1B and OPT. End the paranoia related to Chinese students, very important piece economically and as well as culturally on our campuses. and tackle the huge elephant in the room, the comprehensive immigration reform that everybody's been shouting for well over three decades now. So we're still holding out hope that something may move on that front. So some good meat in the letters there. So kudos to those presidents for taking that initiative, and I wish more would do it outside of just, we got an issue we need to rally around now. That has to happen, yes, and have more of your institutions' presidents do that. But when it can happen at key moments in our history as a nation, coming out of a pandemic, transition in leadership in D.C., I think these kinds of messages can have a real impact, and certainly are excellent PR for institutions getting messaging out to the president-elect in this case. But it also makes as an international educator on campus, it makes you feel a lot better about what you're doing when you have that kind of backing from your institutional president. So that's great to see those two. Now, the final story, this is a little bit of an odd one coming out of Western Australia, one of the states in regional Australia that are outside of the main population centers in the south and east of the country. The article's title is Stink from the Corpse. WA Universities, Western Australia Universities, caught in vicious cycle for rankings, research, and revenue. And the reason I bring this up is we know in the United States that we have a love-hate relationship with rankings, no matter which ranking systems you follow or all ranking systems that you follow and hope you're mentioned in something. We love them when we're in, and we hate them when we're not. And that is a real challenge because internationally we know that rankings in many countries can be a very important distinguishing factor in whether people will even consider looking at you as an institution. And this is something that we think we have an obsession with rankings, or parents in the U.S. have an obsession with the rankings. It's next level stuff when it comes to other countries in terms of their interpretation of rankings. And in this case, in Western Australia, and in Australia in more general terms, there are only 37 institutions, higher ed university level institutions in the country, many more vocational and college level courses as well. But there are four public universities in Western Australia. Academics from three of the four public institutions there are calling for a royal commission into higher education as an obsession with university rankings and publishing research is overtaking their fundamental mission to deliver quality education to students. And what's driving that? What's driving this drive for over-focus or hyper-focus on rankings and research? That's the fear is that that because many of the institutions in Australia are driven by dollars, as are all institutions, frankly, but are going all in on international to the detriment of what their primary focus is in terms of education. That they're pursuing this international money and that leads to federal research funding has turned them into what they call research businesses. In this article. So there's whistleblowers that have that suggest that some of the state's most important institutions are caught in this what they call a vicious cycle of chasing expensive researchers and getting more research papers published in prestigious journals in order to climb global university rankings, which in turn delivers lucrative international students whose fees in turn help fund more research. So again, that vicious cycle piece. So rankings mean everything for these Australian universities because that's how they generate the student interest in their programs, particularly in China, that lead to and India and other countries that lead to the revenue that they charge over the top fees for from their international audiences. So a lot to think about, and I bring this one up just to say rankings are impact every country that's serious about international education, and some countries more than others in terms of that vicious cycle piece, I don't know if we're to that level of hyper-focus on the research funding and impact on global university rankings. I don't think we're, as other than the top-level folks that are already up there, are worried about those kind of things. But interesting discussions today. Looking forward to continuing the conversations in 2021. But that's all we have for now, and we look forward to chatting again in the new year. Have a wonderful day, and happy holidays.